all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Increasing clouds tonight, lows 23 to 29, and cloudy tomorrow with highs in the 40s. More news is next.
People of the younger generation have been really hungry for a long time to have someone who is willing to just take a risk.
It was a good election night for Democrats. What can we learn from the results across the country?
For Wednesday, November 5th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Supreme Court heard a case challenging President Trump's tariff authority.
I speak to California's Attorney General Rob Bonta, who watched the arguments play out.
We need to have the rule of law. We need to have rights and freedoms protected. We need the Constitution adhered to.
Also, views from around the world on the New York City mayoral race.
And can you eat seafood while preserving threatened species?
Two chefs on the French coast of Brittany say oui.
What is the tide? It's a relation with the moon and the sun. So here we don't cook the same thing when you are in big tide or in low tide.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. President Trump is lashing out at the New York City mayor-elect Zohran Mamdani. As NPR's Franco Ordonez reports, Trump suggested New Yorkers will leave the city as a result of the election.
In his first public remarks, specifically addressing the mayor-elect's victory, Trump suggested Zohran Mamdani represented the future direction of the Democratic Party.
After last night's results, the decision facing all Americans could not be more clear. We have a choice between communism and common sense.
Trump charged that New Yorkers will flee the city as a result. Mamdani rejects the label of a communist. Earlier in the day, he criticized Trump for failing to deliver on his campaign promises to deliver cheaper groceries. Mamdani campaigned on a platform of affordability. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, the White House.
Historically, young Americans aren't big participants in off-year elections, but as NPR's Elena Moore reports, they helped carry Democrats to victory on Tuesday in several key races.
From gubernatorial matchups in New Jersey and Virginia to the mayoral race in New York City, youth turnout appears to have significantly increased, according to an early analysis from the research organization Circle. Exit polls also show young people overwhelmingly backed Democrats. Mikey Sherrill in New Jersey and Abigail Spamberger in Virginia each received roughly 70% of the under 30 vote in their gubernatorial races. And in New York City, nearly 80% of young voters cast a ballot for Zohran Mamdani for mayor. Concern about the rising cost of living was a key theme in each race and remains a major issue for young voters across the country. Elena Moore, NPR News.
California Republicans have filed a lawsuit to block a new congressional map that voters approved yesterday. The map aims to help Democrats flip up to 5 congressional seats in next year's midterm elections. Republicans argue the map illegally uses race to redraw the map in favor of Hispanic voters. They're asking the court to block the new districts before the 2026 elections. The Federal Aviation Administration says it will reduce air traffic by 10% across 40 of the country's largest markets starting Friday. The agency is dealing with a shortage of air traffic controllers who are working unpaid, and some have called out of work during the government shutdown. FAA Administrator Brian Bedford says the move will help ensure safe travel.
We have decided that a 10% reduction in scheduled capacity would be appropriate to, again, continue to take the pressure off of our controllers. And as we continue to see staffing triggers, there will be additional measures that will be taken in those specific markets.
Bedford and Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy declined to specify which cities would be affected. They said they'll meet with airline leaders to figure out how to safely implement the reduction. Stocks gained ground on Wall Street today after upbeat economic updates. This is NPR News. The Food and Drug Administration is warning about unapproved versions of Botox and similar anti-wrinkle injections. The agency sent 18 letters to websites offering counterfeit versions of the injectable cosmetic treatment. The action comes after reports of serious side effects, including toxic poisoning. Botox is made from botulinum toxin, one of the most toxic substances in the world. President Trump's renominating billionaire businessman Jared Isaacman to lead NASA, NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports.
Jared Isaacman is a wealthy entrepreneur who's been to space twice in capsules operated by SpaceX, the company run by Elon Musk. Isaacman is the first private citizen to ever go on a spacewalk. When President Trump previously withdrew Isaacman's nomination, he said at the time he had concerns about Isaacman's political leanings. Now, though, in a social media post, President Trump has announced Isaacman is his choice to be the head of NASA, making no reference to the first nomination. The Senate must confirm Isaacman, whose nomination comes as NASA and its contractor SpaceX are facing delays in their efforts to return humans to the moon. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
The return to Earth for a group of Chinese astronauts has been delayed after their spacecraft was believed to be struck by a small piece of debris. The return was scheduled for today, but has been pushed back indefinitely, according to state broadcaster CCTV. The three astronauts were finishing a six-month rotation. Their replacements on the mission successfully docked onto the space station last weekend. I'm Ryland Barton. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at MelvilleTrust.org.
It's 5:06. Thanks for listening to People Powered KAXC and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is looking for people to collect tree seeds and cones this fall and winter. Current high-demand species include jack pine, black spruce, and red pine. Visit mndnr.gov/seedcone for more information. Coming up at 5:30, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Right now, it's more from All Things Considered.
From NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. In race after race, from congressional redistricting here in California to seats on the Public Service Commission in Georgia, Democrats won. They also won key governor's races in Virginia and New Jersey. Overall, it was a big night in the states for the party out of power in Washington. NPR political reporter Elena Moore and senior national political correspondent Mara Liasson followed races across the country. Hey to both of you.
Hi there.
Hey, Elsa.
Hey. Okay, so let's start with what worked for the Democrats. Mara, to start with you, do we know what specific messages from Democrats really resonated with voters? Like, did you see a through line to these very different races last night?
I think there was a through line, only there were very different versions of it. It was a message that married an anti-Trump message with a positive message about affordability, that life is too expensive, the reason is Donald Trump, from tariffs to what he's doing to enrich himself and his billionaire friends, but that Democrats are going to bring the cost of living down. Also, the political laws of gravity have not been repealed. When a president is unpopular and his policies are unpopular, his party usually suffers in off-year or midterm elections, and that's exactly what happened.
We should also say young voters turned out in droves for Democrats, and really elected this, what we can see as a new generation of leaders in Virginia, New Jersey, and New York City. You know, historically, young people don't engage heavily in off-year elections, but they kind of carried these candidates to victory, or at least helped carry these candidates to victory. Exit polls show that Mikey Sherrill in New Jersey and Abigail Spanberger in Virginia each received roughly 70% of the under 30 vote.
Wow.
And in New York City, nearly 80% voted for Zohran Mamdani. I've been talking to Gen Z and millennials about him all week, and they really feel seen by him. I mean, remember, Elsa, he's only 34. Dylan Robertson is one voter who supported him in Manhattan. He's 32.
People of the younger generation have been really hungry for a long time to have someone who is willing to just take a risk.
And, you know, these races that we're talking about all have big differences. But as Mara said, that through line is affordability.
Okay. Well, as far as Republicans are concerned, President Trump weighed in last night on social media. And he said, yeah, it was not a good night for anybody in the Republican Party. Mara, what did we learn about Republicans last night?
Well, the Post was really interesting. Donald Trump said there were two main reasons for the Republican loss. One was the shutdown. He did not call it the Democrat shutdown, as he normally has. Mm-hmm. And then the other one was him not being on the ballot. And what's so interesting about that is he is never going to be on the ballot again.
Right.
And what he was saying was, if I wasn't on the ballot, we couldn't energize Republicans. But last night showed us that Donald Trump does energize Democrats, whether he's on the ballot or not.
Well, Elena, how much was President Trump a factor in New York? Because he did endorse Andrew Cuomo, who, of course, ran as an independent and was Mamdani's closest competitor in that mayoral race.
Yeah, I mean, Trump is always a factor in some respects. And Mamdani did call out Trump directly in his speech pretty forcefully, vowing not to waver in his values. But I would say that this election in New York City was essentially a choice between two versions of the Democratic Party, two generations of the Democratic Party. Former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo was pushing a message rooted in his experience and, this political pragmatism, while Mamdani ran on challenging literally the Democratic status quo and focused on big, ambitious ideas. And I think, the New York City mayor's race is an example and a reminder that in many liberal places, progressives and young people especially have grown increasingly disaffected. And Democrats are going to have to find a way to win them back. And Mamdani's win may be an example of how to do that.
Well, Mark, can we talk more about the variation we are seeing inside the Democratic Party? Because Mamdani had a really different political message from the two other Democrats who won last night in New Jersey, in Virginia. What do you take away from the different ways Democrats are carving different paths to victory?
Well, I take away that Democrats have to do that. Virginia and New Jersey are different than New York City. Mm-hmm. And they're all talking about affordability, but only Mamdani was talking about government-run grocery stores or free buses. In Virginia and New Jersey, they talked about affordability in a different way, bringing down energy costs. And I think that the mark of a mature party is that they can speak to the people who are in front of them. I don't think you're going to see Mamdani's platform and proposals replicated in anywhere else in the country, except for maybe another blue city. But I do think that his social media strategy, the way he campaigned, that's something that Democrats can learn from.
Well, Democrats also won out here in California, where voters approved a temporary plan to allow partisan redistricting all through the state. What does all of this tell us about what may be ahead in next year's midterms?
May be ahead is more partisan redistricting.
Yeah.
And I think now California is going to try to carve out five or so Democratic-leaning districts. The president started this all off by asking Texas to find him five more Republican-leaning districts. And this is now, I think, going to become a permanent feature, mid-cycle partisan gerrymandering. And in that game, I still think Republicans have the advantage. They have the ability to redistrict in many more states. And that's going to be one force in this election against the other one, which is that you now have a very unpopular president. You have a very unpopular incumbent party, and voters don't like their policies. And we'll see if the Republicans can gerrymander their way out of what should be a traditional midterm loss.
That is NPR's Mara Liasson and Elena Moore. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Elsa.
Today, the Israeli military took NPR's Daniel Estrin inside Gaza for the first time since the war broke out 2 years ago. He was with a group of journalists taken to the line that divides Gaza between the Israeli-occupied part and the area under Hamas control. Israel only allows select journalists into Gaza for brief visits escorted by soldiers. And as a condition of the visit, Israel's military censor reviewed NPR's raw audio and video. None of the content of this report was altered. Here is NPR's Daniel Estrin.
It's nearly a month since the Gaza war ended, and I'm in an Israeli military vehicle with a group of journalists driving into Gaza. Before the war, anyone going in and out of Gaza walked through airport-style metal detectors and a maze of gates. None of that is here now.
So we've driven right through the Israeli fence. There are a couple of Israeli military jeeps behind us.
It takes only minutes to reach a military outpost close to the yellow line, the spot in Gaza where Israeli troops pulled back to when the war ended.
Now we're walking through a small Israeli base. A soldier without his shirt on, shaving. Another soldier just come out of the shower with his underwear on, a towel over his shoulder.
One soldier's wearing a t-shirt in English that says Hamas Hunting Club. Another speaks about his wife looking after their six children back home in Israel. And aside from their chatter, it's utterly quiet in this place once known as one of the most densely populated in the world.
Now we're climbing up.
I climb up to the top of a tall dirt berm where Israeli military spokesman Nadav Shoshani gives an overview, and I catch my first glimpse of the outskirts of Gaza City.
Wow.
Oh, so, guys, I'll give a quick explanation. As you're seeing in front of you is the battlefield of Sajaiya. To the left is Gaza City.
I feel like my heart sank just climbing up to the top of this mound of dirt, looking at this expanse of destruction. I'm looking at the tall, high-rise buildings of Gaza City that are still standing in the distance. But around it, piles of cement, bombed-out schools and homes. It's quiet, except for the chatter of Israeli soldiers behind me. I barely see any shrubbery or any trees, just vast expanses of crumpled cement homes and cement beams sticking out of the dirt like tall tombstones.
The war is over, but Palestinians aren't allowed to return to live in this half of Gaza, where Israeli troops are stationed. The troops are active, finding and destroying parts of Hamas tunnels. And Hamas is active too, regrouping and consolidating its control of its half of Gaza, where Palestinians live. The body of American-Israeli hostage Itai Chen was recovered from this part of Gaza Tuesday. Once Hamas finishes handing over the remains of Israel's dead hostages, the U.S. plan is for a multinational peacekeeping force to deploy in Gaza and for Hamas to disarm. Only then will Israel withdraw its troops from Gaza, says military spokesman Shoshani.
We would be glad for that to happen immediately and as soon as possible, but we are ready to operate here to protect our civilians as long as that's not happening.
This is the most uncertain moment of the ceasefire. Will these next steps proceed as planned? If not, is the alternative a return to war? And is this temporary division of Gaza into two the new status quo? The Israeli military has been occupying the West Bank, the other Palestinian territory, for more than 50 years. Shoshani says the military is prepared to remain in Gaza for a long time. At the edge of this devastation, this Israeli military outpost has a tall cell phone tower, electricity poles, fortified walls.
We built the infrastructure here to be suitable for troops, to have normal conditions of staying here for a prolonged time. Our time here depends on how fast the stages of the agreement move forward.
For years before the war, I would enter Gaza every few months to report for NPR. I remember driving through the bustling streets of the Shajaiya neighborhood on my way to the center of Gaza City. During the war, it was the site of fierce battles. I've seen the photos of the destruction on my phone, my computer screen. But to stand before that monochrome wasteland and watch it go on and on. And this is as far as I'm allowed to go. The war is over, but Israel still does not allow journalists to enter Gaza independently to report firsthand how life there has been rendered unlivable. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Gaza.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:18. Thanks for listening to People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. There is more ahead from All Things Considered. Coming up at 5:30, the Up North Report, local news from our region. 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from the CBC with a Canadian perspective. 7 o'clock tonight, Ken McBride, your volunteer host for On the River, will bring you a great mix of music. More great music continues at 10 o'clock on Headwaters with Kari Headland. And in the 11 o'clock hour, you'll hear a live session with Megan and the Birdwatcher. Programming on KAXE, KVXE is supported in part by the Minnesota Humanities Center, distributing more than $6 million in cultural heritage grants. Funds are available to individuals and organizations that will create, celebrate, and teach the art, culture, and heritage of the states with diverse culture. That includes, but is not limited to, indigenous organizations, historically underrepresented communities, recent immigrant communities, and veterans. Application and deadline information online at mnhum.org/grants. Taking a look at our weather, tonight increasing clouds, lows 23 to 29, cloudy tomorrow with highs in the low to upper 40s, southeast winds up to 20 miles per hour. Lows tomorrow night in the low 30s, slight chance for some mixed precip, and Friday chance of sprinkles or flurries, cloudy skies, highs 34 to 41. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's Apple Service Center in Bemidji and Grand Rapids, offering both in-warranty and out-of-warranty service on Apple products and computer repair. More at paulbunyan.net. We also thank Patterson's Clothing in downtown Bemidji, an apparel retailer serving the Northwood since 1930. Patterson's features clothing from brands such as Cool, Patagonia, Darn Tough, and Smartwool. Patterson'sClothing.com. There's more ahead from All Things Considered on KAXE.
PR comes from this station. And from the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Top Trump administration officials often deny detaining U.S. citizens in their ongoing immigration sweeps across the country. Here's Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem in Indiana last week.
There's no American citizens have been arrested or detained. We focus on those that are here illegally. And anything that you would hear or report that would be different than that is simply not true and false reporting.
Here to fact check the administration's claims is NPR's Adrian Florido. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
So, Adrian, Secretary Noem claimed that her agents conducting these roundups have not arrested or detained any U.S. citizens. Tell us, is this true?
It is not true, and there's plenty of evidence that it's false. Many news outlets, including NPR, have reported on and spoken with U.S. citizens who've been arrested or temporarily detained by immigration agents. I recently spoke with one, George Redis. He's an Army veteran who was pulled out of his car by federal agents who were raiding a farm north of Los Angeles.
They sent me down in the dirt with my hands zip tied behind my back. They asked me for my ID once. I let them know it's in my car and I could provide proof I'm a citizen. They didn't care. They never asked me again. They just left it at that.
Redis was held for 3 days, Juana, before being released. DHS later said that he was arrested for becoming violent and refusing to cooperate with agents, which he denies. He was never charged, and he's just one of many U.S. citizens we know have been detained or arrested.
Well, do we have a sense of how many U.S. citizens have been detained or arrested?
The government doesn't track this. What we know is gleaned from videos, lawsuits from detained citizens, and tracking by news outlets. ProPublica recently tallied up at least 170 U.S. citizens arrested or temporarily detained, but that was almost certainly an undercount. In late September, when immigration agents raided an apartment building in Chicago, for example, as NPR reported, they detained dozens of U.S. citizens in just one night.
You mentioned lawsuits that have been filed by U.S. citizens. What are we learning in court about these arrests and detentions?
The lawsuits are piling up. The ACLU filed one in L.A. on behalf of several Latinos who said they'd been racially profiled. One of them, Jason Brian Gavidia, is a U.S. citizen who was working at a tow truck yard when Border Patrol agents marched in, they handcuffed him, and they held him against a fence. He told me about how he pleaded with the agents.
Let me show you my ID. Let me prove to you my legal status. They don't care about that. They care the fact that I was brown and that I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that is not right. We're in America. That is not right.
Gavidia was let go after about half an hour, but another U.S. citizen was arrested in that raid and held for more than 4 days. That racial profiling case is working its way through the federal courts. Other plaintiffs in other lawsuits are trying to stop federal agents from entering private property without warrants. Some are seeking compensation for violation of civil rights.
Adrian, we've talked about Secretary Noem's false claim, but what else does the government say?
Well, in past statements, DHS has acknowledged arresting or temporarily detaining U.S. citizens, but has said it does not target them and has said that those temporarily detained have been set free once agents determine their legal status. People ICE has arrested are often accused of assaulting agents, but in many cases, no charges were pursued. Civil rights lawyers involved in these cases, who I've spoken to, say that agents are casting such a wide net, rounding people up without reasonable suspicion and threatening the rights of everyone in this country.
NPR's Adrian Florido in Los Angeles, thank you so much.
Thank you, Juana.
The world's oceans are being plundered by industrial fishing. According to the United Nations, more than one-third of global fish stocks are now being harvested at biologically unsustainable levels. So, can you eat seafood while preserving threatened species? Well, two Michelin star chefs on the French coast of Brittany certainly think so. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports on their crusade to save the seas one diner at a time.
Hugo Oranger looks out across the Bay of Mont-Saint-Michel from his restaurant, Le Coquillage, tucked inside a gray stone chateau high on a bluff. He says on a clear day, you can see the bay's iconic 10th century island monastery.
If they chose to build Le Mont-Saint-Michel in this place at that time, there must have been something special going on here.
The free-spirited 37-year-old has just earned his third Michelin star. That's great, he says, but what really compels him is this bay with its vast tides.
You grow up by the sea, and it's always a relation with the sea and with the tide. And what is the tide? It's a relation with the moon and the sun. So we don't cook the same thing when you are in big tide or in a low tide.
Because, he says, the fish and shellfish are different at high and low tide. Roulanger's father opened Le Coquillage and earned its first Michelin star. As a boy, he says he had no desire to follow in his father's footsteps. He joined the merchant marine as a ship captain, but sailing around the world led him back home.
When we are out on the sea, you understand that the Earth is mostly liquid. It's a liquid planet, but sometimes you forget this. And when you are a chef and you can buy a cuisine, you can try to protect this element.
France is one of the EU's biggest consumers of seafood, with much of it eaten in restaurants. That gives chefs like Roulanger a lot of power over what's served and caught. Down in the kitchen, final preparations for lunch are underway. A sous chef sharpens his knife to fillet a giant sea bass. Roulanger only serves fish in the summer that's caught by local small fishermen.
Par exemple, l'hiver, vous venez l'hiver, il y a quasiment pas de poisson. On travaille que des coquillages crustacés.
In the winter, we work with crustaceans, shellfish, and algae, Roulanger tells me, switching to French. Because fish have seasons, he says, just like vegetables, and you shouldn't eat them when they're reproducing.
Il faut se rappeler que on mange du sauvage, en fait.
We have to remember that we are eating wild animals. It's like wild game, and it is no banal act to kill and eat fish. The sea is not inexhaustible. Eating fish should be reserved for special occasions.
Hugo's father, Olivier Roulanger, arrives on the bluff.
Bonjour.
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 This longtime chef, now retired from the kitchen, helped save the threatened bluefin tuna in the aughts. As head of an international hotel restaurant network, he convinced hundreds of chefs across the U.S., Europe, and Japan to take it off their menus. It worked. He says Japanese sushi masters who'd been furious later thanked him when the species was saved.
We saved scallops in this region. 40 years ago, they were becoming extinct, so we restricted the fishing season. Sea bass, you just have to stop eating it in winter for it to come back. Science knows what to do. We just have to follow.
La mer, l'océan.
Roulanger calls the sea humanity's cupboard and small fishermen the key to keeping it stocked. If they disappear, he says, our oceans would be depleted by overfishing, and that cupboard would become a trash can. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Brittany.
This is NPR News.
It is 529. You're listening to People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in just a few moments, the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find lots of local stories at KAXE.org. Support comes from Bridget's Pub in downtown Bemidji, serving Irish and American food. Offering Monday night trivia at 6:30 and open mic night on Thursday starting at 6:30. More on Facebook. Increasing clouds tonight, lows in the 20s, cloudy tomorrow with highs in the 40s.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. A Hoyt Lakes man was charged with second-degree intentional murder Wednesday in the killing of a 24-year-old Hibbing man. 30-year-old Daniel James Dale allegedly shot and killed Parker Charles Johnson early Sunday in the parking lot of Meadowview Apartments. According to the criminal complaint, Johnson was shot once in the face and twice in the back. The men were separately attending an after-party at the apartments after visiting a local bar. In a statement to police, Dale allegedly confessed to shooting Johnson. He said he'd shot him in self-defense after Johnson took a long gun out of his truck and pointed it at Dale. But law enforcement say autopsy and security footage evidence contradict Dale's version of events. He faces up to 40 years in prison. Dale's unconditional bail was set at $1 million Wednesday morning, and he was still in custody that afternoon. Two groups are taking Hermantown to court over a proposed data center. Larissa Donovan has been following the story.
The grassroots group Stop the Hermantown Data Center has joined forces with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, the state's largest nonprofit environmental law firm. J.T. Haynes is with the MCEA's Duluth office. He says the lawsuit filed Wednesday is pushing back against the city's Alternative Urban Area-Wide Review, or AUAR, for the proposed development.
This AUAR process that Hermantown and other cities have undertaken, it's not adequate environmental review. We are seeing a pattern of the usage of this AUAR very recently. There's been an unusual number of them this year, and they're all in relation to these data center proposals.
The court case attempts to appeal the Hermantown Council's area-wide review on the basis that the large-scale data center was not disclosed. The Hermantown City Council approved a zoning change for the project early in October, but an October 15th petition prompted the pause of any permits until the Hermantown Council decided its next steps.
There needs to be real environmental review here that complies with state law.
Joe Wickland, speaking on behalf of the Hermantown Council on this matter, confirmed receipt of the lawsuit.
We'll conduct the appropriate review and due diligence and follow the legal process.
Larissa Donovan, KAXE News.
While a majority of Minnesota school districts had their referendums approved Tuesday, that was not the case in northern Minnesota. There were 10 no's and 9 yeses. Chelsea Perkins has more.
We're kind of skipping around here, jumping for joy, if I'm being honest.
That's Crosby Ironton Superintendent Rick Ollie. The district saw its third attempt at an operating levy in as many years pass. A resounding 68.5% of more than 3,500 people who voted said yes. Without passage, the district would face another $1 million or more in cuts, on top of $1 million it's already made. Ollie says the school board was also explicit with what it would use tax dollars for if voters supported the measure.
Our school is a pillar of this community, and we were in jeopardy of losing that. So I think the messaging was outstanding.
Ollie also credits grassroots support groups across the district who helped motivate people to get to the polls. Sarah Nelson Katzenberger is a district parent and a member of Project Unite, a group of parents, teachers, and business owners in Crosby Ironton. She says it was important for this group to figure out who might be getting missed in the district's messaging. A social media campaign idea the group borrowed from Walker Hackensack Akeley took on a life of its own. WHA, by the way, also passed a levy on Tuesday.
There's probably close to 100 people that wrote basically why they voted yes. And it was teachers, healthcare providers, people with kids in the district, people who don't have kids in the district who just see the value of having a strong school in your community.
The Clearbrook-Gonvick School District was one of several that saw their referendums rejected. More than half of the voters there said no to a capital bond request for up to $35 million to upgrade the school. Superintendent Ryan Groh says the district still has options for some of the projects.
The last legislative session, legislators did allow roof projects to be levied as part of the long-term facility maintenance.
We'll be following along as school districts across our region decide how to move forward, whether they got a yes or a no. Chelsea Perkins, KAXC News.
That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXC News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, offering their dining and entertainment card, Saver. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Luminescence Foundation. Luminescence Foundation is dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Next year, the Supreme Court will decide whether the president can use a five-decade-old Emergency Powers Act to shape the U.S. economy. Trump invoked the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA, last spring when he imposed sweeping tariffs of at least 10% across all countries. Today, the nine justices heard oral arguments in the case, and however they decided, this ruling could affect economic policy and presidential power for years to come. At the court today, watching all of this play out, was California Attorney General Rob Bonta. He's a Democrat. And Attorney General Bonta joins me here in studio. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thanks for having me. Honored to be here.
Thanks for being here. So I just want to start with this. Obviously, we'll turn to tariffs in just a moment, but it was a big day for your party, a big day for Democrats up and down the ballot. Yesterday, Democrats achieved two governorships in New Jersey and Virginia. There was a big vote in your state supporting redistricting. What message do you take away from what we saw from voters last evening?
A couple. One, that the status quo is not working for voters. It was very much a referendum on Trump. He wasn't on the ballot, but he was essentially on the ballot. Folks were pushing back against his policies, and it turns out that people like the rule of law, they like democracy, they like the Constitution, they want hungry people to be fed, they want Americans to have affordable health care, they don't want our cities to be militarized, and they don't want tariffs that raise costs. And they don't want ICE as masked agents all over our cities either. So that was, I think, declared loud and clear by the voters who came out.
Let's turn now to those tariffs and to the Supreme Court. In your role as Attorney General of the state of California, you filed a friend of the court brief in this case. And as I understand it, the core of your argument, one that is supported by California's Governor Gavin Newsom, is that the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA, it does not cover the use of tariffs. Am I understanding that correctly?
100% correct. Tariffs are taxes. Congress has the power to tax. It's in Article 1 of the United States Constitution, the statute upon which the president relies to impose tariffs of 10% to 145% across nearly all of our trading partners. It doesn't mention the word tariffs once. And in other statutes where the federal government wants to give authority to the president, they mention the word tariffs. They delegate that authority clearly. Also, IEEPA has never been used in nearly 50 years of its existence to impose a tariff by any prior president. So he doesn't have the authority. We think it's very clear. And the U.S. Supreme Court argument today, I think, surfaced those key issues very clearly.
There have, though, been other rulings under a previous statute that said that tariffs are indeed within the president's power to regulate trade. How would you respond to that?
When a statute gives the power to impose tariffs by the president, they say it. And they use the word tariff or other clear language. There's no such clear expression of delegation of tariff authority to the president in IEEPA. So IEEPA has never been used for imposing tariffs by any president. And that's the statute.
But I think, though, about the precursor to IEEPA, which was the Trading with the Enemy Act, which was enacted then during World War I,
And that has been brought up in this case.
It has been brought up. And that was not a U.S. Supreme Court case.
Right.
IEEPA was a statute that was passed by Congress after the Trading with the Enemy Act. Mm-hmm. And it was meant to create constraints and restrictions. And every other statute that confers tariff-making authority on the president says it. IEEPA did not. And so the prior case on the Trading with the Enemy Act does not get the government where they hope to go here with the broad-ranging, unlimited authority to impose tariffs against any country for any amount of time.
This tariff case is one of a number in which you're fighting the Trump administration. If I'm correct, there were 46 lawsuits, to be exact, some of these aimed at accessing federal funds that have been withheld by the Trump administration. There was another suit over the use of the National Guard in the state of California. Some observers might take a look at the number of lawsuits out there and say that you are using the courts as a way to thwart policies that you simply do not agree with politically. What would you say to that?
I think it's interesting that they would draw that conclusion as opposed to saying, wow, the president is really violating the law a lot, because that's what's happening. And that's all that we look at. It's not partisan. It's a legal question. Is he breaking the law? Do the facts justify our case? Is he hurting our states? And so we only have one position. If he breaks the law, we sue him. If he doesn't break the law, we don't. I think the proof is in the pudding. We've brought 46 cases in 41 weeks, more than one a week. We're winning over 80% of the time, securing temporary restraining orders, preliminary injunctions, permanent final injunctions and judgments in cases. So that means he's breaking the law and that we're right. And we only, you know, look at these cases from a sterile, dispassionate perspective. Is he breaking the law? If the answer is yes, we sue him. And the court's decisions have shown that we're right and that he's breaking the law.
Now, as I take stock of all of these suits, they're really all about the use and limits of presidential power. And the Trump administration is really continuing a trend that we've seen politically for decades of the executive branch claiming these broad powers. Explain to me why this case is different.
This is part of the sort of fringe theory of a unitary executive, that the executive branch has expansive power that is not conferred upon it by the U.S. Constitution. The U.S. Constitution very clearly has three co-equal branches of government. The president has been acting as if he's a king, a monarch, a tyrant, and the Constitution rejects that fact. And so this tariffs case is an example of the president overreaching, again, trying to seize authority that is not his, trying to take from Congress their authority, trying to trespass on Congress's constitutionally given authority. And so it requires the court to interpret the law and render an order that says, get back in your lane, Mr. President. You do not have the authority here. You're exercising authority that does not belong to you, belongs to Congress, and you cannot impose tariffs.
This is a court that we've seen in the past, though, the makeup of this particular court that has seemed inclined to preserve a rather muscular identity of the executive power, a muscular understanding of what that looks like. Do you expect this case to be any different?
I do. Based on what I heard in the courtroom today, there's definitely some on the court, not all, but some who believe in a more muscular executive branch, but they also read the Constitution, are going to interpret the Constitution as it should be interpreted, and they can clearly read, like anyone else can, that the Constitution says that Congress has the power to tax, and that tariffs are taxes, and that unless clearly delegated to the president cannot exercise that congressional authority. And they had a lot of discussion today about the plain and unambiguous text, the legislative history, the historical precedent and context, and I think a lot of signs for hope that there's no indication that the president has the authority that he thinks he has.
Before I let you go, I do just want to bring this back to the stakes for American households, for American consumers. If the Supreme Court does indeed uphold President Trump's use of emergency powers to impose these tariffs, what does that mean for everyday people, including in your state?
Devastating. And it's already been devastating to workers, to families, to small businesses, to moms and pops just trying to survive. Costs have gone up. California is projected to have an economic hit of $25 billion, lose 64,000 jobs. California is the biggest state in the nation, fourth largest economy in the world. We are the largest importer of any state, the second largest exporter, the largest agricultural exporter, the largest manufacturer. We are an outsized economy. And so these tariffs have an outsized impact on California. And it's about everyday people who deserve better than to have a president who is breaking the law, making their cost of living higher and hurting them. And businesses don't have predictability or certainty. This has been a war on Christmas. The shelves will be empty and or the cost will be much higher. And Americans deserve better than a lawless president making their costs higher in a time when they need their costs, and they deserve their costs to be lowered.
California Attorney General Rob Bonta, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Juana.
To see the full interview on camera, check out the video on npr.org or YouTube.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The U.S. is seeing a decline in international tourists this year, about 9%. The number of Canadian visitors has plummeted. But after an initial drop, there's an uptick in travelers from Mexico, despite higher costs and new requirements for tourist visas. Angela Kacherga with member station KTEP has this report.
The area around the U.S. consulate in Juarez is bustling with activity. There are medical clinics, hotels, and restaurants, and agencies helping people prepare their visa applications. The Juarez consulate issues the most U.S. visas in the world, from work permits to family and tourist visas, all for people who want to enter the U.S. legally.
Visitar a mi hermana, a Indiana.
Carolina did not want us to use her full name. She's afraid speaking to the media could affect approval of her tourist visa. She wants to visit her sister in Indiana. Since President Trump took office this year, all applicants, even those renewing their visitor visa, have to show up for an in-person interview. And in October, the cost increased from $185 to $435 because of a new visa integrity fee. On top of that, the entry form tracking arrivals went from $6 to $30. Plus, authorities are checking visa applicants' social media feeds to see if they're critical of Trump administration policies.
Now they want to see your social media, and they want to make sure that you don't have anything that you reposted or that you posted.
Tony Payan researches U.S.-Mexico relations at Rice University's Baker Institute. He says the new requirements are part of an effort to limit all kinds of visas, ranging from students to skilled workers.
I think the basic message is that you're not welcome in the United States. Even tourists who often come and spend money in the country are not welcome.
But visitors from Mexico keep traveling here. According to data from the National Travel and Tourism Office, through August, about 3 million visitors arrived by air from Mexico. That's up slightly over the same period last year. The number of people driving through ports of entry grew by 13% this year, according to U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Every fall, Raul Vargas's tour company brings busloads of fans from Monterrey, Mexico, to Dallas Cowboys games.
La gente no vienen muy contentos, pero pues sí vienen.
He says these days the people coming are not happy because of their team's mediocre record and the higher cost of visas. Even so, they're among the millions of middle-class Mexicans who visit the U.S. every year to enjoy entertainment and shopping.
This is the outlet shops at El Paso.
Malls in border states like Texas rely on those tourists. At the outlet shops of El Paso, 65% of customers on weekends are from Mexico, says Gina Selecta, director of marketing for this mall and another one in Laredo.
Those consumers are very important to us.
Despite the higher cost and new requirements, she believes Mexican shoppers will show up this holiday season.
They'll make other sacrifices, but making Christmas special for their children and their family members, that's someplace that people just do not make those sacrifices.
It's the reason so many line up at the U.S. consulate in Juarez, hoping for a tourist visa that allows them to fulfill their dream of visiting relatives, seeing a show in Las Vegas, or taking the family to an amusement park. For NPR News, I'm Angela Cocherga in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thanks for listening to People Powered KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. It is 5:48. Ahead, we'll hear more on the background of New York City Mayor-elect Zohran Mamdani, and we'll have a wildcard segment with singer Brandi Carlile talking about writing her new album by retreating from the version of herself on the stage. At 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. We'll also hear the set list in there, some live music to check out this weekend. And coming up at 7 o'clock, Ken McBride, your volunteer host for On the River. Support comes from Bemidji Brewing, offering rotating taproom exclusive beers and crawlers to go. The latest offerings available Tuesday through Thursday, 2 to 10, Friday and Saturday, 11 to 10, and Sunday, 11 to 7. More at BemidjiBeer.com. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Increasing clouds tonight, lows 23 to 29, and cloudy tomorrow. Highs ranging from 42 to 49, southeast winds gusting up to 20 miles per hour. Our lows tomorrow night in the low 30s, slight chance for some mixed precip. And for Friday, chance of sprinkles or flurries, cloudy, highs 34 to 41, northwest winds 5 to 15. Support comes from the Bonner Eye Clinic, introducing Dr. Abby Spur to their team at both locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, performing routine eye exams, assisting with post-op care after surgery, and more. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. You can take part in a community read-in at the Bemidji Public Library from 5 to 6 p.m. Mondays in November. Gather to read quietly together, demonstrate support, and celebrate the library. And Stage North Theater presents 10 November, The Wreck of the Edmunds Fitzgerald, November 7th through the 10th at the Franklin Arts Center in Brainerd. Showtimes and tickets at stagenorththeater.com.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Zoran Mamdani's rise to New York City mayor is making waves far beyond the five boroughs of the city. Born in Uganda to a family of Indian descent, Mamdani's win is drawing attention around the world, and progressive politicians are taking note. For a view from abroad, we've turned to our correspondents in Asia, Europe, and first, Africa, with reporter Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
I got the three mysterious chapati. Origins of India, but born in Eugene. Rock brown skin, Bundy Mona, Uganda.
That's rapper Young Cardamon, probably now better known as Zoran Mamdani, the youngest mayor-elect of one of the world's most important cities. In this decade-old music video, filmed in his birth country, Uganda, Mamdani nods to his Indian roots, then quickly switches to Luganda, the local language of the East African country. Even his second name, Kwame, is African. Ugandan journalist Joseph Bayanga mentored Mamdani when he was getting work experience in media in Kampala. He said the mayor-elect had a social conscience, even as a teenager.
His questions were always about this and this has happened. How does it affect the people? He was always in touch with the common man, so it's not anything new. It's just grown bigger now he has it on a big stage.
Mamdani's family left Uganda when he was five and moved to South Africa, where apartheid had just ended. St. George's Grammar School in Cape Town congratulated their famous alumni on Wednesday, urging him to uphold the school motto, which is the courage to do what is right.
I'm Fatima Al-Kassab in London, where the left-wing mayor is the son of immigrant parents.
People are wondering what it is about this Muslim mayor who leads a liberal, multicultural, progressive city.
That's Sadiq Khan back in September. Lots of comparisons are made between him and Zoran Mamdani. Both are their city's first Muslim mayor, and both have clashed with President Trump. But politically, Mamdani is considered further to the left and more similar to figures like UK Green Party leader Zach Polanski, who spoke on Sky News.
I feel like I'm grinning from ear to ear. It just feels like a delightful moment where hope has triumphed.
Polanski has excited younger voters and seen a surge in the polls for the Green Party. The press is even asking if he will become Britain's answer to New York City's mayor-elect. In fact, it seems that everyone wants to be the British Mamdani, or French Mamdani.
Vote for Zoran for a city you can afford. The slogan campaign de Zoran Mamdani.
That's French member of the European Parliament, Manon Aubry, campaigning for Mamdani in New York last week. She was one of a group of left-wing European politicians who came before the vote to learn the secrets to his surprising success.
I'm Dia Hadid in Mumbai, the city where Zoran Mamdani's father was born. Mamdani's victory was headline news in South Asia. Why not? His roots run deep here. His Hindu mother was raised in New Delhi, Meera Nair, an Oscar-nominated director. His Muslim father is a Ugandan citizen who was born in Mumbai. But in India, Zoran Mamdani's victory was met coolly by the Hindu Nationalist Governing Party, the BJP, led by the Prime Minister Narendra Modi. That's because the mayor-elect once called Modi a war criminal. He accused him of being behind communal riots that raged through the western state of Gujarat in 2002 that killed more than 1,000 people, at the time when Modi was the chief minister. The Indian Supreme Court later found no evidence to prosecute Modi of any wrongdoing. But there are others who embrace Mamdani for his talk about the India he loves, a tolerant, multi-faith nation. He seemed to nod to those people after his victory was declared when he referenced an iconic speech by India's independence leader, Jawaharlal Nehru. He said, "A moment comes, but rarely in history, where we step out from the old to the new, when an age ends and when the soul of a nation long suppressed finds utterance." And tonight, he said, "We have stepped out from the old into the new."
That was NPR's Dia Hadid in Mumbai. Earlier, we heard from Fatima Al-Kassab in London and Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
Every week, a guest draws a card from NPR's Wildcard deck and answers a big question about their life. Brandi Carlile says that in order to write her new album, she had to retreat from the version of herself on stage.
I love to entertain. I sang background vocals for an Elvis impersonator from the time I was like a teenager. And I love Elvis Presley. And I love like the great entertainers who they have a grandiosity about them and a sparkliness. But there's also a selflessness in setting self aside to entertain.
The new album is Returning to Myself. Carlile spoke with Wildcard host Rachel Martin.
What have you found surprising about getting older?
What I found surprising about getting older is that I really like it. I like the way it feels in my heart and mind. I like the way I look. I like the way my face looks. I don't think I loved being young or having that kind of chaos meteor tail behind me, you know? And I got a lot of older friends. And so I can see the end of the road. I know what it looks like.
And that doesn't wig you out? That doesn't intimidate you?
I mean, I'm terrified of like death, and I'm not a big mortality zen person. But I do like it. I do like getting older.
Yeah.
A lot. Do you?
I feel ambivalent about
it. Do you?
I'm a little older than you are, Brandi Carlile, and things start to happen to a woman's body. And there are parts of the aging process that really suck.
Yeah.
But
I mean, I do hurt.
I mean,
the aches and pains, that's a
weird
bummer.
Joint pains.
That's a bummer. I know what you
I'm
mean.
I'm like super scratchy on my back all of a sudden.
Scratchy?
Yeah,
your back.
I don't know. There's all kinds of weird symptoms with menopause. I digress. But I do like being in a place where I don't care so much.
Yeah, that's the best.
It's really a freeing thing, you know? I want to wear weird clothes to my kids' baseball games.
All that is better than not being sore, honestly.
Yeah.
Like, I don't like
it. Is. It outweighs the downsides of the aging right now for me, too.
Right.
I guess. You talk me into it.
Yeah, just embrace the heating pad.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do. I have three heating pads now. Three.
Oh, my God. You know, I'm not trying to name drop, but my friendship with Annie Lennox consists of us sending each other pictures of our heating pads and our bed before we go to sleep in random hotel rooms. When I met Alanis Morissette in May, she's sent me three heating pads since I met her. She's got like all of these heating pads that she recommends.
Come on!
Yeah, that girl is all about like taking care of yourself.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the heating pad is a magical, magical thing that more people should understand and use on a regular basis.
Underrated. And they can go anywhere. Commercial flights. I mean,
totally.
People look at you funny, just take them out, plug them in, and just be comfortable.
That is a great idea.
I know.
It may be the most important thing I've learned today.
Yeah.
You can watch a longer conversation with Brandi Carlile by searching for @NPRWildcard on YouTube. Her new album, Returning to Myself, is out now.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Kresge Foundation with Pathbreakers, a podcast about transforming communities through innovation, from revolutionizing higher education to supporting artists who are driving change. Pathbreakers is available on podcast platforms. And from Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. This is NPR.
It's just before 6 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. You can also find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. We'll also hear the set list. Support comes from Timberlake Lodge and Hotel in Grand Rapids. On-site amenities include a restaurant with a full bar and the Grand Splash pool area with water slides and a hot tub.